My name is Mark Rothstein from the University of Louisville, and first, I want to apologize. I have laryngitis, and I'm going to do the best I can, but laryngitis is the best evidence for the value of PowerPoint. So there are several slides. I will just hit the clicker and point to it, and then maybe you can, in unison, read it. I've also been delegated the responsibility of being sort of the moderator or the MC of this entire panel. So let me just briefly tell you that after my talk, to give you the preview of it, is I'm going to indicate my profound skepticism for whole genome sequencing of asymptomatic individuals on a population-wide basis. And following me will be my friend Hank Greeley from Stanford, who will indicate his profound skepticism for my talk. On the grounds
that... whether your talk will make any difference.
Oh, well, yes. Right. So I guess he's going to characterize my talk as quixotic or naive or something. And then after Hank is my friend Nita Farahani from Duke, and she's going to talk about the work of the Presidential Commission, which she is a commissioner on, and I'm anxious to hear what she has to say about her work and her views on these issues. So now we're off to my talk. I'm sure you all have seen this slide. Even if you haven't seen the slide, you've seen lots of slides like it in the last day, and it indicates the sharp decline in the cost of whole genome sequencing, which I'm told now is in the $3,000 to $4,000 range, heading down to $1,000, $100, or pick a number, and that's going to make it feasible to increase greatly the number of people who have whole genome sequencing. I'm going to talk about whether that's a good idea. It's certainly a good idea for people who are in one of these categories, who have a rare disorder that we can't figure out what it is, or who are going to be put on warfarin and we're trying to figure out what the appropriate dose is, or who have a tumor and we're trying to figure out the most effective chemotherapy to put the individual on. But even in that group, this is not magic. As to individuals who have whole genome sequencing for rare disorders, we love to look at, and it's wonderful to see these miraculous cases, children who were profoundly ill, and now they're running and playing baseball and stuff, and isn't that great? That's less than 1% of the uses. Maybe it'll be more in the future than that now. We could have whole genome sequencing on a population-wide basis in many different ways. I think the first real push will be in newborn screening. And Francis Collins, of course, is on record saying we're going to have whole genome sequencing for every newborn who's born in the country, and I'm not sure that's a great idea. And here are all the other ways as well. Keep in mind that the folks on the prior slides were people who were already affected or who were at increased risk. What I'm talking about is people who are asymptomatic. And this is a slide that I borrowed. Well, that implies that I'm going to give it back. that I'm using with permission from George Post at Arizona State. And basically, to illustrate, this is the disease frequency vertically and horizontally running at the top. Why? There's your new pointer. From high to low. And so where we've been in the past is in the lower left quadrant, right? Monogenic rare diseases, inborn maternal errors of metabolism and so forth. We're going sort of diagonally toward the upper right quadrant, and yet we're not really there yet. And another way of illustrating that is with another slide that I'm perhaps going to use. Yes, I remember that. Thank you, Jessica. Okay. So this is another one of George's slides. Illustrates the same point, but if you couldn't get the other one, well, I don't know where they're going to get this one either. The green are the areas where we have... Well, whatever. Still doesn't. The green areas are the areas where whole genome sequencing or whole exome sequencing works well. All right, here we go. Okay, so in the green areas, we can already use genetic testing with some value, but most of the area is filled in red, and that is an indication that we don't have it ready to go yet. Let's skip again. Okay. So population-wide whole genome sequencing, I believe, is a form of medical screening. And we know that from a statistical or analytic standpoint, it's problematic, especially when you screen a whole population with a low prevalence of the condition. It doesn't really matter how the sensitivity or specificity is. We're going to have lots of false positives. And we're still fighting the battles of medical screening that started decades ago in things like mammography and PSA and even newborn screening as to whether it's appropriate for use on a population-wide basis. Here are the traditional criteria for medical screening of all kinds. You want to use it for a disease with serious consequences, where there's a high prevalence, where it is very sensitive and specific, detects little pseudo-disease, has a high accuracy for detecting the preclinical disease, and it detects disease early enough where there's an intervention. The screening itself doesn't cause harm. It's affordable. There's treatment that's effective at the pre-symptomatic stage, and the treatment itself is not too risky or toxic. If we think of those 10 criteria and apply them to whole genome or whole exome sequencing of asymptomatic populations, I think the conclusion is that it fails the traditional medical screening criteria. The fact that we're doing the entire genome will, according to the current estimates, result in between 100 and 300 or so, quote, abnormal findings that need to be followed up, monitored, explained, and reacted to. For many of these, it will be an increased risk, but we don't know what the increased risk is, and much of the information will not have actionability attached to it. The alternative is targeted sequencing strategies, and some of the testing labs already offer these targeted sequencing opportunities. So you could sequence for a range of cancer genes, and they would do the whole sequencing. And you can see the list. What I want to talk to you about, if I can have a minute, please, are my 10 concerns about population-wide whole genome sequencing. And the first one is the lack of clinical utility. There's no justification for doing pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic screening unless there is clinical utility actionable before their symptoms. One of the arguments that you sometimes hear to defend whole genome sequencing is that, we're developing so many pharmacogenomic-based drugs that even if there's, quote, nothing wrong with you now, it's inevitable that over 5 or 10 years you're going to be treated for something where a pharmacogenomic component of your treatment is required, and therefore we'll have it on hand because your genome's not going to change. And we don't want to wait the days or weeks to get the results back. And I was just talking recently, 5 minutes ago, with Larry Silverman about the what he called the third generation of genomic testing, which is using nanopore technology. And this is sort of within an hour you're going to be able to get the results. So the pharmacogenomic rationale, I think, does not really make it. There have been several studies of the predictive value of whole genome sequencing for common disorders. And if you've read the studies, 1%, 2%, 3%, that's it. Another rationale is the research rationale. All right, we don't have anything that we can do with this information now clinically, but what a great database we're creating for research purposes. And that may be true, but if that's your intent, we have a whole regimen of things that we do before we do research on people. You know, IRB approval, informed consent, and so forth. We don't say, oh, it may not work for the reason we're giving you, but on the side, we're going to use it for research. Second, and we've talked about this as well recently, in the last day or so, the lack of regulation by the FDA of the sequencing machines and the laboratories as well. We're going to have one of the interesting things that I thought of when I was listening to Larry talk about the price coming down for the sequencers is whether we're going to change the model from sending stuff out to these large reference laboratories to doing the sequencing in-house. And so instead of, you know, 24 people who do this, we're going to have thousands of people doing it the way we do blood tests in hospital settings. And what challenges are presented by that? We're certainly going to need large numbers of sequencing machine operators, laboratory technicians, supervisors. They all need to be certified. They all have different credentials. And as I point out, some of them are going to need new wardrobes as well. One of the big problems is the lack of standards for interpretation. The results, the output may be standardized, but the interpretation is going to be different. How is it going to be done? Is it going to be done with proprietary software? Is it going to be done with generic open source software? Is anybody going to certify it? And then we have the issue of might as well testing, which was the problem from lunch yesterday, if you recall, right? We already have to do the sequencing for this narrow purpose. Well, while we're doing it, we might as well do the whole genome because it's not going to cost any more. Well, maybe in dollars, but it may cost more in other ways. We've also talked about the issue of the lack of strategy for dealing with incidental findings. And I know this has been talked about before, and I probably shouldn't talk about it, but I will. And that is the ACMG's March 2013 recommendations. To recap, if you want whole genome sequencing, according to ACMG, the sequencing must include testing for these 57 genes. And it doesn't matter what condition you have, what age you are, or your patient's age. It doesn't matter whether they want, whether they're going to have any plans to act on the information. It doesn't matter whether the clinician thinks it's medically indicated. Some group thought that this stuff is so important that you must do it. And it doesn't indicate the implications for reimbursement. So what we have is a situation where we're going to have 57 varieties of genetic tests that are mandated. And it doesn't really matter whether you want them. And it doesn't matter whether your physician thinks you need them. You're going to have them. And we're calling this personalized medicine. Just about to mention. By contrast, I don't know how many of you seen this, but within the last 2 weeks, the European Society of Human Genetics came out with its statement. And I'll try to read it if I can. When in the clinical setting, either targeted sequencing as I suggested, or whole genome sequencing is possible. It is preferable to use a targeted approach first in order to avoid what they call unsolicited findings or findings that cannot be interpreted. Filtering should limit the analysis to specific genes and known genetic variants with limited or no clinical utility should be filtered out. So the European Society of Human Genetics has taken the, I don't want to say the opposite, but certainly quite a different approach than ACMG has. We've also talked about this, the lack of genetics professionals. There are only about 1,100 medical geneticists and a little over 3,000 genetic counselors. I don't see many of them going to work and just reading the newspaper, wishing they had something to do. Where are we going to find the people to provide the counseling? Where are we going to find the clinicians who are ready, willing, and able to do the pretest and post-test counseling and so forth? We also have a very daunting challenge with the population's lack of health literacy and numeracy. I know there are many counselors out here, and if you can't explain to somebody what the difference between a 25% risk and a 50% risk is, add 500 or 1,000 more conditions, and the risks are smaller and contingent. Right? It's 2% of this, but it may be 2.5% if you also have this. It's going to be a very challenging situation. The other problem is lack of probability. People are not going to be able to calculate what that means. So I think information that's incomplete, opaque, constantly changing, plus you have people who may have had high school biology and high school math, and put those two together, and I think it is not a good situation. Okay. Now, something that I think we haven't really addressed directly yet today is the possibility that there is going to be widespread lack of equitable access to genetic services. I'm not talking about the tests. I'm talking about services. Even assuming that all the people who are insured, uninsured, private, public, they had access to the test, they may not have access to the counseling, and they may well not have the access to the follow-up services that are indicated. We're going to find that people have, 100 risk factors that are related to genetics. We're committing to a sort of a lifetime of medical monitoring, surveillance, and follow-up. Who's going to have access to that? The more frequent colonoscopies or the pharmacogenomic-based drugs that are a follow-up of the tests. One tragic thing that could come out of this would be if whole genome sequencing increased rather than decreased health disparities and increased health inequities. And I don't think that's, totally unrealistic to think that that's a possibility. Financially, I don't think it's we would have a return on investment under any calculation of costs. So even if we use the $1,000 cost just for the test, we're talking about $100 billion if we screened one-third of the population. If we only did newborn screening, that would be $4 billion a year. Could we do something with $4 billion a year to improve early childhood health? We screen now for 30, 40, maybe even 50, depending on the state, conditions with newborn screening. In many areas, the follow-up is really lacking. Parents have to pay out of pocket for follow-up tests. They can't get it. In some places, they can't even get the PKU diet or the sort of the basic things that they need as a result of newborn screening. If we had $4 billion to spend, just think of the prenatal care we could offer, the well baby care, and so on and so forth. It doesn't make sense, in my view. We also have a problem if as a country, we were going to say, okay, everybody should have their whole genome sequenced and maybe walk around with their chip in their pocket, you would think that we would have a comprehensive health privacy law. We don't. HIPAA was not intended to be a comprehensive health privacy law. It was to govern the payment chain of three distinct covered entities, providers, plans, and then these clearinghouses of health information. It doesn't apply to employers. It doesn't apply to life insurers. It doesn't apply to all the people who can get your medical information. And what are they going to do with it? It doesn't even apply to providers who, say, engage only in cash transactions. The other thing we don't have is a comprehensive non-discrimination law. And Jessica talked about Gina yesterday, but just to mention a few things, it only applies to people who are asymptomatic, and it only applies in the health insurance and employment spheres. Right? Look at all the other possible uses of this. So now we're cranking out information that we can't protect and may not be able to use. And one thing about the Americans with Disabilities Act, if you thought about it, here's the gap between these two laws, GINA and the ADA. GINA says we're only covering you if you're asymptomatic. On the other hand, the ADA says you're not covered unless you have a condition that substantially limits a major life activity. In between is lots of stuff. And we're finding all those things, right? Would epigenetics be covered? Would biomarkers be covered? Would all the other indicators of early onset of symptoms be covered? The answer is no. You could argue that not only the ADA, but GINA as well, are based on sort of 1990s view of genetics. And unless we update them, we're going to have all these gaps in coverage. And also, keep in mind, many people think that privacy considerations are, we're worried about the rogue employee or the hacker and so forth. What I'm worried about is the lawful disclosure of information, where a third party with economic leverage over you says, sign here if you want this life insurance policy. That's legal. Or an employer says, well, we're happy to give you this job, but it's conditioned on your passing a medical examination. Sign here. We want all your records. That's legal. That's where privacy is breached. And number 10, finally, and this is something that counselors deal with all the time, the lack of attention to psychosocial harms and long-term implications. If you just think about the kinds of things that we deal with in clinical genetics all the time, depression, survivor guilt, misattributed paternity in 5% or more of cases, vulnerable child syndrome, where now every child after newborn screening is going to be wrapped in bubble wrap for their entire childhood. And we're going to be creating a whole society of people who are worried, who could be called the worry well. If you all knew that you had some predisposition to a late-onset neurological disorder, every time you drop your keys, uh-oh, here we go. All right, I need to start, you know, calling the home and get my room in. So we're going to have kids who are worried well. We're going to have nail biters who are worried well, and just all-purpose people who are worried well. Okay, so that's Ann Wojcicki, of co-founder of 23andMe, and she was quoted last year in the New York Times as saying, your information is your information. If you want it, you should be able to get it. Translation, if you pay us, we'll be happy to provide it to you. But it raises the issue of sort of, well, aren't I being overly paternalistic by saying all these bad things could happen? Maybe people want that information, and if they want that information, they should have a right to it. Well, I think there are some justifications for paternalism. We have paternalism in federal regulation of laboratories, right? I couldn't open up a lab in my basement and start doing blood work for the hospital. We have consumer protection laws, and I think that's one of the things. Direct-to-consumer genetic testing needs greater consumer protection about some of the claims that are made. And also, if you're talking about federal dollars or state dollars, we have the stewardship responsibility of not spending our taxpayer dollars on something that doesn't work. So I would say that if you want to have 23andMe or, you know, Navigenics or one of the other companies do a whole genome sequencing or exome sequencing or whatever, and you want to pay for it and you enter into it without being misled, fine. But that, in my view, is not a strategy for public health. So in conclusion, I don't think population-wide whole genome sequence is a scientific manifest destiny. We spent all this money developing this. We can do it now, and by golly, we're going to do it. I don't think that's the good idea. Just because it can be done doesn't mean we ought to do it, or at least it ought to be done now. And this is a good place for primum non nocere, first do no harm. So, Gil, do I have time to take a question? Okay. So I have time to take a question, and then you'll hear why maybe my concerns will not be heeded by people. Yes?
Well, I was just going to underline what you said. We don't teach how to help people, but the issue of the burden of disease. We're very bad at that. And as you said, the possibility of turning, you know, the whole population into the worried well. Well, we don't do well with the people who are not well already. So, let's have to bring some more people in.
No. Right. And we don't do well with people who are worried for no reason.